This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Almost 30 years after his death, many regard Mao Zedong as both a great and a terrible man. One of the founders of the Chinese Communist Party, a champion of the peasants, a brilliant and heroic military commander who led the Red Army on the famous Long March and fought the Japanese during World War II. The man who drove the Nationalists off the mainland and united his country, and who, despite the deplorable excesses of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, paved the way for China to emerge as a great power in the 21st century. Now, a new book paints Mao as a monster on a par with Hitler and Stalin and challenges almost every part of the conventional biography. It's written by Yung Chang, who described the suffering of her family during the Cultural Revolution in the bestseller Wild Swans, and her husband, the historian John Halliday. They spent 10 years documenting the life of Chairman Mao, including interviews with members of his inner circle, and they incorporate newly available information from Soviet archives. Some critics charge that the result is an unrelenting polemic, and they question the author's sources. Most, though, describe the book as a compelling and convincing study that will destroy Mao's reputation forever and challenge the political system that he left behind. Later in the program, a follow-up report on U.S. intelligence reform from the 9/11 Commission. Lee Hamilton will join us. But first, Mao, the unknown story. If you have questions about the life and legacy of Mao Zedong, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Authors Yung Chang and John Halliday join us now from the studios of the CBC in Toronto, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having us.
Let me begin. It seems to me that, one of the most devastating things you've reported is that both the Chinese Communist Party and, to a large extent, Mao himself are creations and tools of the Soviet Union.
Yes, Mao came to power in the Chinese Communist Party entirely due to Stalin. Stalin spotted Mao in the late 1920s and pushed him to the top of the party. And in fact, Mao's colleagues couldn't stand him and threw him out in 1932 and then tried to leave him behind when they embarked on the Long March, which was nothing to do with Mao. In fact, Mao's colleagues asked the Russians if they'd take Mao off their hands and take him to Moscow so they wouldn't have to work with him. But the Russians just sent the cables and just said, you've got to work with this guy and keep him on board. And that's the only reason he even got on the Long March.
And Yung Chang, the reason his colleagues agreed to that was because the Soviet Union was funding the Chinese Communist Party.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the Chinese Communist Party was founded by Moscow in 1920. And even the idea of forming this Chinese Communist Party came from the Russians. It wasn't the idea of any of the Chinese. They agreed to it, but the idea came from Moscow.
One of the things, there's a bunch of fascinating material about the early life of Mao Zedong. And one of the things you write about is in the winter of 1917-18, he was still a student as he turned 24 and wrote extensive commentaries, including about morality. I do not agree with the view that to be moral, the motive of one's action has to be benefiting others. This among many other things, but the selfishness involved in this, you say, is a defining characteristic of the rest of his life.
Yes, absolutely. In that commentary, he explicitly said he rejects the concept of conscience, the concept of responsibility, and even good names after death. And he said, I act on my own impulses, and I do what I like, and I automatically have the best morality. And the thing is, he wrote these words when he was 24, but these formed his basic ethics throughout his long life of 82 years and became part of his policy when he took power. In fact, the language he used in the Cultural Revolution in his last years when I was living in China, the language was exactly the same.
And similarly, you write that his early experiences with the communist movement when he was, again, still a young man in the countryside, watching what were at the time thugs, that unlocked in him a lust for both power and an attraction for violence.
Yes, that was 1927. Mao had been in the party for, you know, six something years. He had been a lukewarm believer. He didn't join the Communist Party after, a long kind of pursuit of ideology. He was at the right place at the right time when the party was formed, and he was given the right job, which was actually to open a bookshop selling communist literature. Mao was poor and he loved books and he welcomed this job. That's how he got kind of involved into the Communist Party. And then he had been a rather sort of moderate person. And then in 1927, he toured the Hunan villages, his home province, and he saw thug violence and atrocities unleashed by a Soviet model. And he said this tour of 32 years changed his life, 32 days, mm-hmm. changed his life. And he said he felt a kind of ecstasy he had never felt before.
And this was, John Halliday, this was a policy he later enacted when he finally did get command of troops of his own, which was something that he angled for in the early days of the Communist Party.
Yes, one of the things we got a lot of documentation on was Mao's first purge, which is in 1930, which, by the way, is actually before Stalin's great purge. And Mao unleashed a horrific level of violence and torture, in fact, on other communists, really to take over a base area which other communists had set up. But what there are two things I found very, very, really upsetting about this was, first of all, the constant use of torture, ordered by Mao. And the second thing was that, when other people tried to protest, in fact, some guys who'd been tortured even broke away and it got to Shanghai, where the Russians had some agents and the official headquarters of the Chinese Communist Party was, and took off their shirts and showed the scars of torture, and the Russians knew this was Mao, but basically they just said, he's our guy, and go ahead. They didn't use the word go ahead, but go mm-hmm. ahead was in fact the message. So Mao, contrary, there is a slight myth around sometimes about Mao that he kind of started as some sort of idealist and gradually got a bit worse and worse and worse down to the Cultural Revolution at the end. But what we show is that he started very, very bad indeed, and he lurched towards violence whenever it suited him or whenever he had the power to do so.
Yes, Yung Chang, there's several passages, but in his descriptions of his, that chaos, in a way, was his ideal, and if in the process of chaos many people died, so what?
Yes, in his character, in his nature, there was this fondness for chaos. But he also knew that he needed order to pursue his goal. His goal, for example, after he took power in China in 1949, was to build a military superpower for him to dominate the world. And for that, he needed some order. But chaos in his character constantly sort of came out, and in a way undermined himself. And in the Cultural Revolution, there was both very extreme control and chaos. The Cultural Revolution started in 1966 and ended 10 years later when he died in 1976. And we saw Mao constantly balancing this fondness for chaos, which created giant upheavals in people's lives in China. I was there. Mm-hmm. All our lives were thrown up and upside down. And also a kind of order with very tight control that invaded everybody's private life. So we had the worst of both worlds.
I'm going to ask you about one more central element of the, I guess at this point we have to call it the Mao mythology, and then we could take calls from listeners. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. And that incident is the famous one described by Edgar Snow during the Long March. One of the things you say, in fact, was that a lot of people may have marched during the Long March, but Mao wasn't one of them. He was riding. This is an incident where it's described as Mao leading his men across this bridge over a gorge that's under enemy fire. In fact, the bridge is on fire. This great heroic moment of the Long March.
Well, as we discovered, there was no fighting at that particular bridge, the bridge over the Dadu River. The reason there was no fighting was that Chiang Kai-shek, Mao's domestic enemy, you know, the head of the nationalists who was in power then, Chiang Kai-shek let the Red Army go. And the reason was that Chiang Kai-shek's only blood son and heir was kept hostage in Russia by Stalin. And Chiang Kai-shek was desperate to have his son back. So he traded the survival of the Red Army for the return of his son. And then, of course, the other myth was somehow Mao marched like the rest of the Red Army. But in fact, as we discovered, he was carried most of the way on the march. And he had actually designed his own litter made of bamboo with a kind of a cover so he could lie back comfortably and being shielded from the sun and the rain. And he later said himself to his staff, he said, during the long march, I was lying in the litter. I had nothing to do. What did I do? I read. I read a lot.
And this is not to say that the description of the other people on the long march, their sufferings was not accurate. You described their knees being scraped raw as they carried this litter up precipitous hillsides and that sort of thing. And, of course, ultimately their reward for this, and part of the evidence for this is the fact that they did get some rewards, but ultimately the reward for this was that they were purged.
Well, Mao on the march, he sabotaged a group of the Red Army led by his party opponent in a kind of a power struggle. I don't know whether that's what you meant. I mean, that was, we were absolutely astonished that Mao would do this.
We're going to continue our conversation with Yong Chang and John Halliday after a short break. They're the authors of Mao, The Unknown Story. Again, if you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation at from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing an important new biography of Chairman Mao, Mao, The Unknown Story. It's part of our continuing series on China. Our guests are authors Yong Chang and John Halliday. You can see photos from Chairman Mao's life and read an excerpt from the book at our website at npr.org. And, of course, you're invited to join the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And, well, let's get some listeners involved right now. This is Ken. Ken calling us from Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Ken. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if you had touched upon Mao's relationship and horrific murder of Lin Biao, as well as the rumors of Lin Biao's survival.
I think our conclusion from our investigation is that Lin Biao did die in the plane crash. Of course, Mao drove him in a way to that death because Mao was about to purge him when Lin Biao fled. Lin Biao was actually Mao's old crony. Their collaboration went back to 1929, and they did all sorts of dirty things together. And Lin Biao became Mao's number two in the Cultural Revolution. Without Lin Biao's collaboration, Mao would not have been able to start the Cultural Revolution. But Mao turned against Lin Biao, and Lin Biao had to flee. And Lin Biao's son, by the way, was probably the only man who actually seriously contemplated an assassination of Mao in Mao's 27 years of reign. And they didn't get anywhere because Mao's security was extremely tight. Lin Biao's son and Lin Biao himself was actually informed by Lin Biao's daughter, which was directly, kind of responsible for the crash.
Ken, did you have a follow-on, Ken?
Actually, that's quite different from I actually used to debrief defectors. And that's actually quite a different version, although very similar to some that I'd heard. I think it's interesting to note that Lin Biao made enough of an impression that well beyond his death, there were rumors that he had somehow survived, but there was never any corroboration on that.
Well, yes, I agree. There are different versions or interpretations. I mean, we interviewed the chief Russian investigator who was sent to dig up to examine the corpses, and in fact went twice and even dug them up again and reportedly, you know, brought the bones of Lin Biao and his wife to Moscow. Where the Russians had x-rays of Lin Biao's skull and other things from the time when Lin Biao had been in Russia for health treatment much earlier, in the late 30s and early 40s. And although, of course, one has to treat some things the Russians say with skepticism, I think that the burden of evidence is very strongly that, I mean, I would say by now overwhelmingly that, Lin Biao was in the plane and was killed in the plane.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in China, you know, I interviewed Lin Biao's surviving family members and members of his personal staff and the Air Force, you know, Lin Biao's base, chief Air Force officers. And the consensus, or they seem to come up with this the fact that Lin Biao did die in the plane crash.
Thanks for the call, Ken.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Brent. Brent's calling us from San Diego.
Hi, how you doing? My name's Brent Haas, and I'm a modern Chinese history PhD student at University of California, San Diego. Mm-hmm. We're actually just fortunate enough to read Dung Chang and John Holliday's book this week for our colloquium in modern Chinese history. And I had a question for them.
Go ahead.
My question is, I celebrate and support their efforts at destroying the quote-unquote Mao myths that are still prevalent today in the People's Republic of China. But I'm a little bit skeptical and worried about their vocabulary and the phrasing, which seems to take us back to the Cold Warrior heyday of scholarship in the 1950s and 60s, using terms such as Reds, focusing on a quote-unquote international communist conspiracy and removing all agency from the Chinese and Chinese nationalists in creating their own communist party. I'd love to hear what Zheng Chang and John Holliday have to say about this in terms of phraseology and in terms of a possible return to Cold War rhetoric and scholarship of modern Chinese history.
John Holliday, why don't you?
Yes. On the terminology, I mean, we use the word Reds because, after all, that's what the term they themselves used at the time. And indeed, you know, a phrase like the Red Army, perfectly acceptable, even about the Russian army in the Second World War. But Edgar Snow's book about China is called Red Star Over China. I mean, it's a perfectly straightforward word. I mean, it's a word that has its own. I mean, it has its roots in the language of the communists themselves. It's not a word stuck on to communists by their opponents. You know, it's an authentic communist self-description. Now, as for the thing of the issue of the Russian role in setting up the Chinese Communist Party and the issue of Cold War scholarship, I think these are two quite separate things. I mean, first of all, we discovered, you know, documentary evidence from the Russian archives, overwhelming evidence. It's beyond dispute that the Chinese Communist Party was set up by the Russians in the interests of the then Russian state.
Wasn't there one year in the 20s where the funding of the Chinese Communist Party was 94% from Moscow and 6% raised in China?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And also that Mao, I mean, the evidence is there in the documents. It was only because Stalin forced Mao onto the other Chinese communists that Mao was at the top and even got on the Long March. So it's nothing to do with the Cold War or anything like that. In fact, some of this evidence wasn't available during the Cold War. I mean, the evidence is there in the documents. And Mao himself said in 1923, he said, when he'd been in the Communist Party less than 3 years, he said, communism hasn't got any hope of coming to power in China unless the Russians invade from the north. So the link between the establishment in the early years of the Chinese Communist Party and the Russians, I think, is documented up to the hilt. And it's nothing to do with the Cold War.
Let me add, let me just ask this. Some critics have said that your book is too one-sided, that it paints a portrait of Mao as a picture of complete evil. There's not three-dimensional, it's just one-dimensional. Were there any redeeming qualities to the man?
Well, when it comes to the moral dimension, I mean, Mao was completely amoral. But our book is not sort of one-dimensional because there are many sides to him. There is the moral side that is completely black, but there are many other sides. And Mao was a strategist, he was a schemer. And he, you know, for example, without him, the Chinese Communist Party would not have been able to come to power. I mean, whatever that says. I mean, he was terrible. He was very smart. He understood human feelings and the psychology, although he himself was completely devoid of pity, for example, and love. And he loved books. I mean, you know, his favorite pastime was to stay in bed reading. He had his giant beds piled half a foot high with books, so he could wake up, roll over, pick up a book, and start reading. But the problem is he wouldn't allow a billion Chinese to read. I mean, he was an opera fan, Chinese opera fan, but he deprived other Chinese of seeing operas. So there were many sides to Mao. And in our book, I think we showed a dramatic life of Mao. Mao was not, it's not just a documentation of his crimes. It's a roller coaster, it's a story of the roller coaster life of Mao, the drama of his life, the ups and downs, and his relationship with Stalin, which was riveting. No two other tyrants had that kind of close relationship, mm-hmm. supporting each other and rivaling each other. And all this is a part of our book.
Yeah. John Halliday, there's another comparison with Stalin. Unlike Hitler, for example, Mao was not a charismatic man, not a dynamic speaker, not the kind of, that cult of personality was developed almost despite his personality. How did he get people to do what he wanted them to do?
Well, first of all, he was working within a very closed, controlled communist system. It didn't require the skills of a great orator. I mean, Mao hardly ever went out into the public domain. I mean, he didn't go out on the street corner make speeches about building hospitals and schools. And he never stood for a vote. He never submitted, in fact, any of his proposals to the Chinese population. You know, those sort of things didn't count. And he knew that. But he did have the fantastic skills of operating in a small group of people in a very secretive system with which you could also bludgeon your enemies with so-called Marxist labels and, you know, that sort of stuff. He was very, very good at. And we've all met people like that. I mean, they operate in a room of 8 to 10 people. And he also, of course, he knew and his colleagues knew he had the backing of Moscow. I mean, this was critical when Mao actually did rise to near the top, let's say, to the envy, the eminence grise of the party on the Long March. His colleagues who hadn't liked him, but they knew he was Stalin's man. Then having got into power, he did have the skills, although he was not a particularly orderly guy himself, he had the skills to spot other people who could run a very, very tight ship for him. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party was a formidable organization, and he was able, although he didn't want to do a lot of the nitty-gritty, but he was very, very beady and very good at spotting other people who would do the work that he wasn't particularly good at.
Brent, thanks very much for the call.
If I may, could I add one thing about this particular, about the caller's particular question? The truth is, as we discovered, you know, the perception of Mao in before Nixon's visit in the 50s and the 60s was actually far more accurate about Mao than the image afterwards. Nixon's visit actually whitewashed Mao and gave the West a misconception of Mao, which was not there in the 50s and 60s. And Nixon for his own political agenda. And Mao, of course, invited Nixon precisely partly to do that. And also he wanted Nixon there to help put himself on the center of the world stage. And the next thing is he wanted to get, sort of American military secret out of Nixon's visit, which he didn't succeed and which he blamed the Watergate for.
We're talking with Yung Chang and John Halliday. They're the authors of the newly published Mao, The Unknown Story. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jay. Jay calling us from Las Vegas.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask the authors if the position in their book, one that tends to dismiss or even disparage Mao, tends to serve the political interests of the current Chinese government?
Well, all I can say on that is, of course, if the Chinese government were to take Mao's portrait down from Tiananmen, or indeed if anybody was, and his corpse out of the middle of the city and his face off the banknotes, that would be a step forward. And to the extent that, I hope, after all, the Chinese people have a right to know about their own history, to the extent this book would help people know what really happened, anything is welcome. But that's a completely different, one can't confuse that with suggesting that in some way, this book could, I've no interest in helping the Chinese Communist Party, hang on to its monopoly of power.
Well, there's some interest in the upper echelons of the Chinese Communist Party to disparage Mao at this time. Does it serve some political interest, in your opinion?
I should just point out at this point the book has been banned in China. Indeed, any magazine or newspaper that has reviews of the book have also been banned. But go ahead, Yung Chang.
Well, yes, I think if anybody in the Chinese leadership who is thinking of rejecting Mao and all Mao's legacies, I think that's an enormous it's a wonderful thing. I mean, I think that would, if our book coincides with that, I would think that's wonderful news. That's wonderful news for China, the wonderful news for the world. You know, Mao was responsible for well over 70 million death of the Chinese in peacetime, and he was bent on dominating the world. And yet the current regime and still sort of says Mao is the great founding father of modern China, and Mao, they claim, the regime claims itself to be Mao's heir. I mean, this is an extremely dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. The world can never regard China as a benign power unless China rejects Mao and all Mao's legacies. If our book can help push China in that direction, I think that's a wonderful thing for us.
Jay, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
John Halliday, I just wanted to ask you, we just have a minute or two left with you, and I did want to ask about the future, though. The myths that you debunk are in many ways the founding myths of the Chinese Communist Party, which, as you said, still has the portrait of Mao in Tiananmen Square. They don't avow all of his policies these days as they used to do, but nevertheless, if the ruling government is founded on mendacity, as we saw in the Soviet Union, ultimately, as these myths are debunked, as people become aware of this, does that not become, it's untenable after a while?
After a while is perhaps the nub of the question, which is, I mean, this regime, Mao died almost 30 years ago, and so this regime has been running, for 30 years, and I certainly can't predict when it would come to an end. I mean, all I can say is I think truth must out. And also, I think a nation which is relying on myth and indeed on the suppression of information and on disinformation, it can never be as strong, not as strong as a nation founded on truth and information. And also, as Jung said, not a nation that other people can feel The sort of confidence that you know, after all, we hope China is going to be a safe country run by a regime one can have trust in. But it's pretty hard to feel safe when they're resting themselves on a myth, particularly a very nasty a myth which is covering up a lot of nasty truths.
John Halliday and Yung Chang, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Their book is Mao, The Unknown Story. They joined us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto, Canada. When we come back from a short break, the Bush administration and Congress get decidedly mixed reviews on intelligence reform from the 9/11 Commission. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.